In our study of the book of Revelation, we have come to chapter 11. There are three judgments that move along the action chronologically in the book of Revelation. It starts with the seal judgments. The seals are being opened on the scroll, and events are hitting the earth, and God's wrath, the day of his wrath, has come. The seventh seal judgment in chapter 8 brought in the seven trumpet judgments. When this seventh trumpet sounds, it will bring in the final bowls of God's wrath, and we will be at the end of the seven-year tribulation time, and the Lord will be returning. Well, we've had the seven seals open. The seventh seal includes the trumpets. We went through the trumpets in chapters 8 and 9. And now we're in a pause in the action. Chapter 10 was a pause sort of for John to get his strength and to be nourished and be told, there's more you must say. Chapter 11 now, I believe, is a look back at the beginning of the seven-year period, and God is going to give us insight into some specifics that are going to be happening during that seven-year time. When we get to chapter 12, we'll see more of the same. In fact, there in chapter 12, we sort of go back to the Garden of Eden almost, the battle of good against evil. And we're going to see how it plays through the ages, and especially how it's going to be intensified during the tribulation time. When we come to chapter 13, God is going to give us details about the Antichrist and how he will rise to power in the beginning half of chapter 13. And in chapter 13, the second half, we see his right-hand man, the false prophet. Usually people, when they think of the tribulation time, they think of the Antichrist, but they don't really, I think, have much understanding of the false prophet, the right-hand man that's going to be helping the deception and helping the power to be given to the Antichrist. So chapter 13 will be very revealing. As we see these events and all that's transpiring during tribulation time, especially after chapter 13 shows how the Antichrist will be set up and his false prophet will deceive everybody, we almost might be giving up hope. Like, if they're in control and all this is being done, you know, who can stand and what will happen? Well, the answer comes back that in chapter 14, the Lord is going to return. His 144,000 are going to be safe waiting there on Mount Zion to welcome him, and the evil people of the Antichrist's world system, they are going to be judged. It's going to be like a sickle just chopping them down. So chapter 14 reminds us of that. And it's at that stage that we get back to the action moving along during the seven-year period. So right now, let's take a look at chapter 11 of Revelation and see some details about that seven-year period, the last 7 years on earth as we know it. John has just eaten the scroll, and now he's getting ready to write more things. I was given a reed like a measuring rod and was told, go and measure the temple of God and the altar and count the worshipers there, but exclude the outer court. Do not measure it because it has been given to the Gentiles. They will trample on the holy city for 42 months. Verse 3 continues, and I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth. And the description goes on to say how no one will be able to stop these two witnesses. Well, here at the beginning of chapter 11, we have the measuring of the temple, and we have the two witnesses. Now, I put a paragraph in this overhead, starting verse 3. I put sort of a break because I believe there is a break in the description. Verse 2 talks about the holy city being trampled on for 42 months. That's 3.5 years. That is the second half of the tribulation time. At the midway point, 3.5 years into it, the Antichrist sets himself up to be worshipped in the temple. He suspends the sacrifices that had initiated the tribulation time. Israel will sign a peace treaty. The Mosque of Omar, that gold dome mosque, will be taken down. The temple will be rebuilt, and sacrifices will start. The world will be saying, peace, peace. That's the first 3.5 years. But the midway point, the holy city is going to be trampled on. And that's that 42 months in verse 2. Verse 3 has another reference to 3.5 years. But note that it's not 42 months. It's said in terms of days, 1,260 days. To me, that's a signal, if you will, that we're not talking about the same 3.5 year periods. I believe the trampling of the holy city clearly is the second half of the tribulation time. But I'll tell you here sometimes where I break a little bit from some of the other scholars, I put the two witnesses, those 1,260 days, which is exactly 3.5 years, prophetic years, 12 months of 30 days each, I put them in the beginning half of the tribulation time. I believe the numbers are given in two different ways to signify that they're two different periods. If the Lord wanted us to understand that the two witnesses were prophesying during that second 3.5 year period, having just said that the holy city will be trampled for 42 months, it would make sense then to say, and the two witnesses will be witnessing during those 42 months. But instead it said, and I'll give power to my witnesses. Now it's a little bit tough, but I don't believe that the witnesses can be in the second 3.5 year period, because when their days are up, and I believe it's a reference to the full 1,260 days that they're prophesying, proclaiming the gospel, when those days are up, they are killed. Now, if we were in the second half of the tribulation time, that would be at the very end. 3.5 years up, end of tribulation time, 7 years exactly. The Lord will return. Well, we find that these two witnesses are going to lay dead in the streets of Jerusalem for 3.5 days. And then they're going to be resurrected, and at the time that they're laying dead, the whole earth is going to be celebrating. I find that impossible if we're at the end of the tribulation time and the bowls of wrath have been hitting. I just don't see how the world will be celebrating and sending gifts back and forth when you're at the last day of the 7-year period. So I believe these two witnesses are in the first half. Logically, it makes sense to me, which is important. No, I'm not in control of Scripture, and God doesn't have to explain himself, and my logic is quite limited, to say the least. But to me, logically, it also makes sense. If the church is raptured pre-trib, God needs a witness. He always has a remnant. He always has a witness. I believe the two witnesses provide that witness. Now, God has also sealed his 144,000, and they are going to be witnesses too. But I just think the day the church is gone, shortly thereafter, the peace treaty will be signed, the tribulation time will start. The rapture will be a witness, I think, at the time in between, when the world is chaotic and so forth. The very nature of the rapture will, I think, convince a lot of people whose lives have been affected by the rapture. But then, when the Antichrist comes, signs the peace treaty, and the whole earth is sort of brought out of that chaos, and they're saying, peace, peace, and isn't man great, and everything's been figured out. At that point, I think God will need a strong witness, and I believe that's when these two witnesses come forward. Well, let's talk about verses 1 and 2. John was given a reed. This is like a yardstick. A reed was lightweight and stiff and could be used commonly to measure. And God has had some Old Testament prophets do this too. When God is measuring something, he's showing his possession of it, his control and possession of it. So God is saying, go measure the temple of God. Now, in the beginning 3.5 years, God is in control, and sacrifices will be offered up to him, and he has ordained this and planned it, so he is in control. And there'll be worshipers there. And I believe there'll be true worshipers. Then verse 2 says, exclude the outer court. Do not measure it. Now, I also think that there'll be false believers coming in. And the statement goes on and explains, verse 2, that the outer court, which is known as the court of the Gentiles, is not to be measured. It doesn't belong to God. And all of a sudden, the idea comes up that the holy city, the temple and Jerusalem, is going to be, in essence, desecrated for 3.5 years, 42 months. So God is saying, I'm in control of the temple. It's going to be set up. At the beginning of the tribulation time, the peace treaty will be signed. It'll be rebuilt, and there'll be true sacrifices offered to me, and there will be true believers there, sincere true believers. Who knows but that the 144,000 might not come from some of those true believers there, and this could even be a reference to God having his people there. The 144,000 are Jews. They're sincere, true Jews, so it makes sense to me that they'd be there in the center of the temple making the right offerings with the right kind of heart attitude. But God goes on to say, for the second 3.5 years, the temple's going to be used by the Antichrist. We'll find out in chapter 13 that he's going to set up an image of himself there in the temple. Jesus referred to it in the Olivet Discourse. He said, when you see the abomination that causes desolation spoken of by Daniel set up in the temple, he said, flee for the hills. And so we'll see that in chapter 13. Then I believe there's a break in the action. Verse 3, that and, we sort of sense it as continuing the action. We sort of link it to the 42 months, but I don't think we should. Verse 1 talked about measuring the temple and the true worshipers there. That's a reference to the first half. So when this and comes up, the previous two verses had been talking about the first and the second half, so I believe that verse 3 is free to be talking about the first or the second half. And again, because it's mentioning days instead of the 42 months, I believe the witnesses will be going about the beginning half of the tribulation time. Now, most of the references concerning the time periods in the tribulation time are in 3.5-year blocks. The first half is characterized as a certain time, and the second half is called the Great Tribulation, and it's another 3.5-year piece. Sometimes people propose that perhaps the witnesses overlap. Maybe they come onto the scene before the midway point, overlap, and they're witnessing in there, and that would give them time to be killed, to lie in the street 3.5 days, still be resurrected, and then the end can come then too. So that is a possibility. Now, what about these two witnesses? You have a choice. You can either go symbolic or you can go literal. Unless the scriptures say this is a sign or it was like this, unless those kinds of words are used, I take it literal. When God says there are two witnesses, I believe there will be two witnesses. You see, once you decide to take it symbolically, you're free to say anything you want. These two witnesses could be blank and blank, and they could symbolize Jews and the church and anything you want. Now, it's said that there are two olive trees and two lampstands. And some people say, well, then it's like, you know, the olive tree stands for Israel, the lampstand, chapter 1, is the churches, and so it could be like Israel and the church. The only problem with that is it says two olive trees. It doesn't say that they're two different people, one olive tree and one lampstand. The imagery there is that both of these guys are like olive trees, both of these guys are like lampstands. That's because they're serving the same purpose that God had designed for Israel in the Old Testament, his olive tree. They were to be a light to all the Gentile nations. They didn't do so good at that. The church age, we are to be a light to all the Gentiles too. These two are going to fulfill it. They're going to do what God's Old Testament people, Israel, should have done, and what hopefully the church as a lampstand is doing. They together are going to be like the two olive trees and the two lampstands. Now, if these are literal people, then everybody starts speculating at this time, and it'd be fruitless for me to continue with the text because everybody is thinking, wait a minute, who are these two guys? And so we better, I'll tell you what, we'll read about them, and then we'll come back and talk about what their identity might be. Verse 5, if anyone tries to harm them, fire comes from their mouths and devours their enemies. That's neat. That's amazing. God is saying these two witnesses are going to be talking. They're going to be proclaiming the truth. For every one of those 1,260 days, they're not going to be shut up. This is how anyone who wants to harm them must die. If that wasn't enough, verse 6 adds, these men have power to shut up the sky so it will not rain during the time they're prophesying. Now, you Old Testament scholars right now are making a connection to some famous Old Testament figure. Elijah shut up the sky. He told Ahab it would not rain. These men not only have the power to shut up the sky so it will not rain during the time they're prophesying, they have the power, it also says, to turn the waters into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they want. And again, Old Testament thoughts come to mind of Moses and Aaron and the Nile turning to blood. Keep in mind, too, that phrase, every kind of plague. They can hit the earth with every kind of plague as often as they want, not just limited to 10 plagues. Now, God seems to, you know, hit the earth with plagues when he's trying to make a point to people who are stubborn and hard-hearted. And that's the way people are going to be at this time. So these two might not just use 10 plagues. They might use 20 or 30 or who knows how many. Well, they are eventually going to be killed. Now, I just add that point before we read about it, because that, along with verses 5 and 6, enters into a lot of people's thinking about who they might be. It mentions they die, and some people recall the statement, it's appointed on a man once to die, and then the judgment. And then people go back in Scripture and they say, wait a minute, there are a couple people who haven't died. Enoch walked with God, and then he wasn't. And Elijah caught up in the whirlwind. So if it's appointed on a man once to die, and those two didn't die, some say it's Enoch and Elijah. Others say, no, it's Elijah because of that shutting up the skies so there's no rain, it's Elijah and Moses, because Moses is the one God used when he wants to hit the earth with plagues. And they say, you know what? On the Mount of Transfiguration, Elijah and Moses were talking to Jesus. And so they say Elijah and Moses are around and capable of coming to earth and being involved in God's plan. So there you have it. And then fistfights break over Enoch and Elijah, or Elijah and Moses. Well, I refer back to that New Testament episode at the Transfiguration, and God there tells us Elijah and Moses were talking to the Lord. It seems to me that if it was Elijah and Moses, or for that sake, even if it was Enoch and Elijah, God would then say so here. He did that at the Mount of Transfiguration. He just didn't say two people came and were talking to Jesus there. He told us who they were because we are familiar with them. I believe if we were familiar with these people, God would tell us who they are, and we could be looking for them. So I happen to believe, because no names are mentioned, they are not going to be any well-known characters from the Old Testament or New Testament for that matter. They could be, and maybe God just didn't want us to worry about it ahead of time, but I happen to believe they'll just be two witnesses that God will pick and empower, and so be it. When you come down to it, it really doesn't matter who they are. The point is, God is going to make sure that he has a witness for 3.5 years. This is going to be as powerful a witness as you could ask on the earth. Two men proclaiming the truth as clear as could be, performing miraculous signs to back up everything they're saying. Now, if the world wants to come to faith, if the world wants to believe, God has provided the witness and all the proof necessary, as he always has in the past, continues to do to this very day, and will do to the very end. Those who reject the truth reject it and deserve then the fate that awaits them. So again, I see throughout the book of Revelation, God putting forth the thought, what more could I do? What more could I do than I've done? Sending my own son, having my witness, having the church, lampstands, olive trees, whatever you want. Throughout history, God has revealed himself. We're told that God has revealed himself through his creation. He has revealed himself through his word. He has revealed himself through prophets, through the signs they do. He's revealed himself through us in the church age. God is consistent and true, and those who reject the truth do so according to John 13, and this is Jesus explaining to Nicodemus. Men reject the light because their deeds are evil. They do not reject the truth because it's illogic and requires some huge leap of faith. It doesn't. It is the most logical response to what a rational human being sees and experiences in this existence. To know that there is a God, to seek for him. The heavens declare his glory. They shout it forth day after day. I was just talking to someone who witnessed the miracle of childbirth recently, and they said, anybody who can see that and not say there's a God in charge of design and creating is foolish. So God has always proclaimed the truth. Those who reject it deserve what they get. Well, these two are going to be on the news every night. CNN says the new witnesses are in Cincinnati. Three River Stadium is no River Stadium right now. It's all dried up. And, you know, they've turned to blood. There's grasshoppers, locusts, you name it, hail. Again, it'll be as powerful a witness as God has ever had. Now, the thought is that people are going to be trying to kill these people. They're trying to harm them. They want to shut them up. They cannot stand them. And I really believe, you know, National Guard troops will be called out, tanks and so forth, and it'll look like an old Godzilla movie. Out of the mouth, fire will come and burn them up. And they will not be silenced. And, you talk about all of Billy Graham's crusades and everything else put together, I believe these two witnesses will be a powerful, powerful voice for God at this crucial time. Well, now we find out how it all ends with these two witnesses, starting in verse 7 of chapter 11. Now, when they have finished their testimony, you see how God's in control? He knows the exact number of days they're going to do it. Nothing can stop them. And then, when God says, okay, fine, perfect, completed, 1,260 days, then it says, the beast that comes up from the abyss will attack them and overpower and kill them. Their bodies will lie in the street of the great city. And we're wondering what great city it is. Well, notice the text says, which is figuratively called Sodom and Gomorrah. If these two witnesses were supposed to be figuratively two witnesses, I believe the text would tell us. The text throughout Revelation is clear. When we get to chapter 12, he's going to see a sign in the heaven, a woman and a dragon, and we know they're symbolic, they're signs. But when it says two witnesses, I think it means two witnesses. So again, I'm a literalist when it comes to Bible, and I believe God uses symbols and metaphors and analogies, but the text will lead you to conclude that. when that's not in the text, you conclude that what he's saying is what he's saying. And his prophecies of old came true literally and factually, and I believe that's what we need to do with the book of Revelation. Well, their bodies will lie in the street of that great city, which is figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, but isn't Sodom and isn't Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. Well, that tells us it's Jerusalem. Now, verse 9, for 3.5 days, men from every people, tribe, language, and nation will gaze on their body and refuse them burial. Gaze is a good translation. They'll fixate on those bodies. Now, this is pretty vile. Even today, when there's hatred and there's a murder and killing, we don't let the bodies just lay in the streets and fixate the cameras on them, and everybody, you know, gloats over it for days and days and days. I'm not sure of this in history, but I'm told when Mussolini was killed, I mean, they abused the body, and there was a period there, but you figure after a while, men go enough, and they're repulsed by it. But for this to go on for 3.5 days, and there's no telling how much longer it would have gone on, to me shows us how vile the world will be when salt and light has been removed. Not only do they gaze on the bodies, verse 10 adds this, the inhabitants of the earth. Now keep in mind, that's a technical phrase for those rebellious, stubborn, hard-hearted people that refuse God's offer of salvation. Those earth dwellers will gloat over them. Another good translation of the word in the Greek. They'll gloat over them and will celebrate by sending each other gifts because the two prophets that had tormented those who lived on the earth. They're celebrating the Dead Prophets Day. Hallmark will have a line of cards put out. It's crazy when you think about it, but this just lets you know the state of affairs in the world. Now, what happens to these two? Well, verse 7 tells us they'll be testifying every single day, and when God says, there, you've done your task, then he will allow them to be killed. This is all part of God's plan. The beast from the abyss, well, that pictures Satan, comes up and attacks them. But in chapter 13, the Antichrist is called the beast. His world system is called the beast. We do that when we talk of events. You could say Hitler invaded Poland. Well, that referred to his whole system. Or you could refer to Hitler himself, you know, gave a speech. So when we say the beast here, and it's this way, especially when we get into chapter 13 and so forth, sometimes we say the beast, much like a historical reference to Hitler or something, and it stands for the whole system, his 10-nation confederation and the empire he's building. Other times it refers to the beast himself, but added to that is the idea of demonic influence, empowerment, and perhaps possession. Same things are probably true of Hitler in the past. Demonic activity and involvement was obviously there, a part of all of that. So whenever you see the beast, I would think in terms of three things: Satan behind it, empowering and working right with him, the individual, the Antichrist himself, but also his whole system. I believe at this point, though, we're at the midway mark of the 7-year tribulation time, and to me it makes sense if the Antichrist himself is victorious, whether he himself, you know, destroys them, you know, one-on-one showdown, high noon, streets of Jerusalem, if that might be it. You know, the fire scares everybody else, destroys everybody else, comes against them. Maybe the beast will now come out and will defeat them one-on-one. Or whatever his plan is to defeat him is going to be successful. Either way, the world is going to say, in essence, the Antichrist just beat those two witnesses. And that's going to make the whole world worship the Antichrist. And I believe it's at that point he sets himself up in the temple to be worshipped. Who is like the beast? Nothing has ever been seen like him. And if people were starting to at all think that these two witnesses were speaking the truth and stood for God, well, when the Antichrist defeats them, he'll probably say about what Christ said in the Gospels. Unless a strong man comes and bind the other, you cannot take over his possession. So in essence, he's saying, I'm stronger than them, and you know, I must be, like Christ was saying, God himself. So to me, it ties in perfectly to have the Antichrist, or the two witnesses, testifying in the first 3.5 years, have it right at the midway point, them defeated, and the Antichrist set himself up to be worshipped, and the whole world caught up in that, and it just sort of seems to put the pieces of the puzzle together. Now, they're going to be lying right there in the streets of Jerusalem, and then verse 9 is a key verse. For 3.5 years, or 3.5 days, men, and then it's very clear, from every people, tribe, language, and nation. All words in the Greek to say every person across the whole world, every kind of tribe, every ethnic group, every race, so forth, will gaze, not just glance, but will be gazing at their bodies and refusing burial. Well, when we read this, you and I picture satellite TV and everybody glued to their television set watching, you know, these bodies laying there and gazing at them. I like a lot of old commentaries, but I've got to turn the tape to side two.